Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to the Commonwealth Club. My name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly, Chair of the Psychology Forum, and we are absolutely delighted to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Denise Davis. Dr. Davis is a general internist, clinical professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco, and she serves as associate director for the faculty development for the San Francisco VA Center of Excellence in Primary Care Education. Dr. Davis teaches faculty development workshops locally and nationally. Incidentally, I've attended two of hers, and they were outstanding. I pass that on to you. On communication skills, including a groundbreaking workshop for the American Academy on Communication and Healthcare on opening discussions about race in clinical settings. Dr. Davis developed and presents trainings for non-physician patient experience professionals. That would include, I suppose, psychologists, social workers, and the art of observing and coaching physicians and improving clinical patient communication. Dr. Davis is a past recipient of the prestigious Kaiser Foundation Award for Excellence in Teaching for her work with students at UCSF School of Medicine and was recognized by UCSF as an outstanding teacher in 2013. She was elected to the UCSF Academy of Medical Educators in 2015. So please, let's welcome Dr. Davis. Thank you.
Thank you for that warm welcome. And again, I'm Denise Davis. And welcome to an hour, 50 minutes perhaps, since this is a psychology series that will be devoted to talking about an exciting innovation in medicine and healthcare, opening conversations about race and relationships. And I approach this topic with a great deal of hope and satisfaction, and I hope you will leave with that also. I began my journey as a naive 12-year-old who decided to go to medical school, thinking that medicine would provide me with a great deal of security. Little did I know about all the tumult that would happen in medicine from the time I began medical school until now. And as a mature, middle-aged, mid-career physician who loves medicine, I also know that though I am well-trained, though I might calculate exactly the right dose of insulin that a patient needs for their diabetes, that does not mean that every patient actually has their blood sugar controlled or that their disease is well managed, because there are powerful forces that are social, that are psychological, that are neurobiological, that affect the relationship between healthcare providers and the patient. And race and ethnicity are a powerful, powerful force that I wish I had learned about in medical school. It was completely ignored, and I really didn't have a clue. So this talk really represents how I'm remedial. The gaps in my knowledge, I think, are being filled in over time. And what better way to be called to learn more than by to teach, which is how I got involved in this. I'd like to know who's in the room in terms of your backgrounds and interests. Since this is a psychology series, how many of you are in mental health? Just three. How many of you are in nursing? One. Social work? Two. How many of you have been patients? Most of us, right? And I think whether you're a psychologist, a social worker, a physician, or you've been a patient, I think this is a topic of interest. If I might introduce myself to you with even more elaboration, I'm a general internist, and I have learned that that job title, that role description, actually is jargon. And I learned that recently introducing myself to a patient at the San Francisco VA, where I have a clinic, and he looked at me quizzically and hesitatingly said, "You know, Dr. Davis, aren't you a little old to be an intern?" And so now I explain what a general internist is. I'm a doctor for adults, and I take care of almost everything that's not surgical. I love what I do. As I said, I see patients at the San Francisco VA, and I'm clinical faculty at University of California, San Francisco, where I teach medical students, residents. I also teach interprofessional trainees, including pharmacy interns, nutrition interns, because we all need communication skills, and that is my area of advanced training, communication in healthcare. My professional home is through the American Academy on Communication in Healthcare, which is one of the best nonprofit organizations that no one has ever heard of. But we've been around since the 70s, and we're an organization devoted to improving what used to be called bedside manner, that sacred relationship between the healthcare provider and the patient. We've also branched out into teamwork, conflict management, giving feedback, and also race and relationship in healthcare. So I'd like to start with a quotation, and that is, courage is what it takes to stand up and speak. Courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen. Winston Churchill, that's his quotation. And I think it's apt for this topic because race and relationship, it's not about a download, about someone telling something. It's as much about listening. And so I teach physicians to listen better as well as to communicate more effectively on a topic that for some people is quite sensitive, and as we said earlier, one that's often avoided. I love medicine so much that I want physicians to connect instead of avoid, to heal instead of harm. So, what's the nature of this topic in terms of my inspiration? This advances. Yes. I'll tell you a story. And for me, it began 2 years ago after the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, two African-American men who died violently in conflicts with police. UCSF students organized into white coats for Black Lives. This is now a national organization, and I'm proud that UCSF students were at the forefront in organizing. And on December 10th, 2014, they lay on the ground silently in a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, interprofessional group of young people. And for 49 minutes, they lay silently in protest. They got our attention. And this changed the minds, and I will say the hearts of leadership at UCSF and the School of Medicine. And out of that came a leadership retreat titled Race and Inequality, and a lot of programs downstream from that. I'll talk more about some of those programs later. The students have been leading us, and I'm very honored that they and enthused that they do. Let's talk a bit about disparities in healthcare. What's the nature of the problem? I'd like to take four different areas: cardiovascular disease, diabetes, preterm labor first, and talk about what the evidence is. So in terms of cardiovascular disease, African Americans have double the rate of heart attack and stroke. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, who is a physician and researcher with UCSF, has found that for younger African American men, their rates of heart failure are 30 times that of their white cohorts. And your reactions are similar to the medical students I teach. They think, oh, Dr. Davis is old. She must have added a zero by mistake. No, it's 30 times the rate. And it's all due to uncontrolled hypertension, high blood pressure. A disturbing disparity. In terms of diabetes, we know that African Americans and Hispanics have about double the rate of diabetes than their white counterparts. And you can conjure up all of the complications that result from that: loss of vision, loss of limbs due to amputation, end-stage kidney disease. And Hispanics have three times the rate of requiring dialysis when they have diabetic complications. A disturbing disparity. In terms of preterm labor, Dr. Paula Braveman, also of UCSF, a shero to me, has discovered that in neighborhoods with long-term high rates of poverty, preterm births occur at a rate 41% greater than in other neighborhoods. And this has prompted the CDC to put out the word that it might be more, your zip code might be more important than your genetic code for some diseases. And I think her research actually highlights how powerful the social determinants of health are. Think of those babies and the discomfort that they may experience when they are born preterm, and then what the families go through. Another disturbing disparity. And lastly, cancer. We know that one out of every five African American men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer during their lives. African American men die at double the rate that white men do who have prostate cancer. And all of this data, right, calls on us to do better. Dr. Catherine Lucy, who's vice dean for education, and who's really been a moral force for us at UCSF, has said that in the same way that UCSF devoted itself, its resources, its faculty, science, to meeting the AIDS and HIV crisis during the 80s and 90s, we're devoting ourselves now to the silent epidemic of disparities due to race and ethnicity in this country. And I'm completely with her. I want to see us make this change, and I know it's possible. I'll finish with saying that of all ethnic groups, First Nation, Native American, and Alaska Native people have the poorest prognosis for survival with cancer of any ethnic group. Very sobering, and a call to those of us who are healers to do better and to make progress. Well, let's think a bit about solutions. Certainly, there are a myriad of things that can be done. Access, better access to healthcare is certainly something that could help reverse some of these disparities. And the Affordable Care Act has disproportionately helped minority people have better equity with health insurance. So a very important piece of progress, I think, in public policy. We think about education, and I think that preschool children should know what a healthy plate of food looks like and should know what healthy exercise is very early in their lives. Public health measures, including immunizations, also a powerful way to reduce disparities. Diversifying the physician workforce would be progress. We know that minority physicians are more likely to take care of minority patients and underserved patients, people who are poor, people who are less likely to have insurance. We have a lot to do with diversifying the physician workforce. I'm proud that UCSF has a student body, incoming student body, that's 34% underrepresented minority. So African American, Latino, first generation to college, low income, and there are some Asian groups that are underrepresented in medicine. So we are making progress, but we have a long way to go. The numbers are much lower with faculty. Percentages of minority faculty in medical schools around the country, I think, averages about 4%. It's quite low. And yet we know that there's really a role for those physicians in reducing disparities. Well, you won't be surprised, since you've heard that I'm really interested in communication. This is a lot of the training and facilitation that I do locally and nationally. I'm really interested in how communication can remedy disparities, racial and ethnic disparities at the interpersonal level. So let's look at that for a minute. These are some of our medical students, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. So in looking at communication as a procedure, not a soft skill, but actually a higher order skill, we've looked at how many interviews physicians will conduct in a full-time career. It's about 200,000 interviews. It's no matter what the specialty physicians are in, whether it's interventional radiology or pediatrics or general internal medicine or family practice, it's the most common procedure. And historically, physicians have received less training, less feedback, less coaching. And unfortunately, I think we've been less effective as a result of that. I don't know about any of you, but I don't want someone to operate on me and remove my appendix if they've only seen one. And yet, with communication, we say, oh, it's your first day. Just go talk to this patient. Interview them. Without it, really much training or skill. Now, we are changing that in medical education, and I'm very happy we do. Now, in terms of training to open conversations about race, ethnicity, relationship, power, language, when I teach around the country and I ask faculty how many of them have had experience, explicit training, I was teaching in Tucson a few months ago, and I asked that question, and one person raised their hand. She's a third-year medical student. None of the faculty physicians really had had any training. So we're remedial, and I hope that we will make progress. In general, communication in healthcare has many benefits, including increased trust and loyalty, decreased malpractice risk. There's a beautiful study in which only the vocal tone of the physician was made evident to the observer. So they filtered out the words. They just heard the tone of voice. And observers were able to discriminate between the physicians who'd been sued twice for malpractice or more versus the physicians who'd never been sued, simply by tone of voice. And we learned that an over-enunciated, dominating tone, those physicians were much more likely to have been sued. And a warm, professional voice saying, "Good morning, Ms. Smith," was associated with a little or no malpractice history claim. Very powerful part of communication. We know that communication is also associated with better health outcomes. So in other words, it's not woo-woo. I practiced in Berkeley for a long time, and right, we're often accused of being woo-woo in Berkeley. But the real numbers indicate that with diabetes, again, if we think back to the data about how Hispanic and African Americans disproportionately suffer from diabetes, this is really important to reversing disparities. So when patients were asked to evaluate the trust and relationship they had with their physicians, if it was satisfactory, those patients had better diabetes control. A test called hemoglobin A1C, which measures how well blood sugar's been controlled, was a full percentage point less, which really matters in terms of complications. It's equivalent to a medication. Good communication. It can save lives. Let's take coronary heart disease. We know that medications as simple as aspirin or as complicated as clot-busting medications can save lives and prevent heart damage. And adherence to those medications, taking those medications regularly, is part of what can keep people healthy. Well, again, when physicians and patients had trusting, high-quality relationships, guess what? Patients were more likely to be adherent to the treatment. And it makes sense to me. Trust, communication, safety, relationship, again, an avenue with which we can begin to reverse some of the gaps in healthcare between minority patients and majority patients. Other health outcomes, we know that HIV and AIDS patients who are suffering with that infection, also adherence is so critical to them because the virus can become resistant if they don't take medications regularly. Again, communication can be life-saving. So I spend most of my time teaching this topic, and I continue to learn more all the time. It continues to unfold out to the horizon. And when I sit next to people on flights, when I go teach in cities around the country and they ask me what I do, that I teach physicians bedside manner, the response is usually, "It's about time." So I'm glad I'm part of this movement. Let's talk about how to make real some of the things that I'm suggesting that could help at the interpersonal level. And let's pretend that we're actually visiting a doctor's office and we pull back the curtain and we look in and we see what's actually happening between a satisfied patient and her doctor. And in this case, let's observe this African-American woman and her African-American physician. What we're likely to see is laughter, smiling, open body position, head nodding, eye contact, and a lot of indicators that there's a lot of positive emotion in the room. And that's what Dr. Lisa Cooper discovered when she videotaped these what are called race concordant visits, in which African-American patients reported high levels of satisfaction with their physician who is of the same ethnic and racial background. There was a lot more positive affect, positive emotion. And I'll defer to the psychologists about where that, you know, the mechanisms in the brain and as to how that physiology occurs, but it's a very powerful factor for patient satisfaction, and patient satisfaction is a marker for quality. There was a recent article published that showed that in health systems most highly rated for patient satisfaction, it was estimated that should patients go to that institution, one out of every 70 lives would be saved because there are lower levels of complications and higher levels of quality in those systems. So it's not just a feel-good thing. It's actually related to quality and safety. So positive emotions aren't in the DNA, right? They're not related to a racial category. And what we're doing with physicians is actually teaching them how to use positive emotion at the beginning of an interview to say, good morning. I love being with you, Ms. Smith, and it's a pleasure to see you again. I'm looking forward to hearing all about what's been happening with your health for the past couple of months since we've met. It seems so simple, doesn't it? And yet, I've observed physicians who come in and say, okay, let's talk about your blood pressure. Yes, right? Yes, exactly. So coaching physicians to use these emotional tools to help build better relationships, especially since we're talking about minority health right now, especially with minority patients. I looked at an article this weekend in preparation for this talk. There were 9 focus groups of African-American patients, and the topic was trust. One of the quotes that really stood out to me is a patient said, he just comes in and starts talking and doesn't even say hello. I don't trust him. So this, I'm hopeful because these skills can be taught. They can be learned if people are willing. And that's what some of us are dedicating our lives to. So let's visit another patient. Let's look through a two-way mirror. And again, African-American patient with an African-American doctor. And what do we notice when we listen in? Sharing of decision-making. More common in these videotapes of these interactions and resulted in higher patient satisfaction. So phrases like, you know your body. I'd really like to hear what it is that you think is good for you, healthy for you, and I'm really interested what you think may not be healthy for you. I am all ears. So teaching these phrases, these tools to physicians and to medical students and nursing students and nutrition interns can help share the decision making. It's not in the DNA. It's on the lips. So let's look at one more doctor-patient interaction. Let's say it's a Hispanic patient with a Hispanic doctor. And the phrases we might hear if we listened in are, wow, that really sounds difficult. Or, you know what? I'm sticking with you, no matter how difficult the going is. Until we find out what's happening with your health, I'm not going to give up. Those are empathetic phrases. And we know from research about Hispanic patients, that's one of the two things that Hispanic patients said that they were most interested in and gave them the most satisfaction and was most likely to result in those patients rating their health care as excellent. Empathy. I would dare say that everyone wants that. I certainly do. You probably do too. But for minority patients, this may be something, you know, exquisitely important. And again, we're learning how to teach these things. We used to say in medicine, oh, you either have it or you don't. But we're finding we can actually help people's brains develop in a way that cultivates more empathy. And I can't remember actually the part of the brain, but it's at the juncture of the frontal, temporal, and parietal lobes of the brain. Researchers have identified an area that's associated with empathy and is lacking in people who have very severe problems like sociopathy or personality disorders who lack empathy. It can be taught. It can be learned. And we've even come up with a mnemonic, PEARLS, partnership, empathy, apology, respect, legitimizing, which might sound like anybody would be upset if they've been waiting for a doctor for 30 minutes. I don't blame you. I have to say that far too often in my work. And the last is support. I'm very supportive of your plan to quit smoking and start exercising. Tell me how you think I could be of help. It's very different than the download, isn't it? Right? Do this, 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 and this. We found that that is not effective. And it's not respectful, and it's not relationship-centered. So empathy. I'd like to talk about what I learned from patients. And my mentor in medical school, she said, and she was my only woman professor in the bad old days, she said, when in doubt, ask the patient. I thought it was such great advice. And so I conducted two focus groups of African American patients in the East Bay and learned a lot from those people in terms of their attitudes about health and healthcare. And what I learned is that I should practice with heart. H-E-A-R-T. It's the only way I could remember the themes is by making up a mnemonic about it. And the H is for hierarchy. And what patients said is that they felt that the hierarchy between the doctor and patient was exaggerated. There's always a hierarchy, or almost always. But for minority patients, they felt it was really exaggerated. And so what's the remedy? The remedy is saying things like, I'd really like to get to know you as a person. What are you interested in doing outside the doctor's office? It doesn't take rocket science, right? But I think an awareness of the hierarchy is really important. We know that interns at Johns Hopkins, when they were observed in the hospital with patients, only 40% of them introduced themselves to the patient. 37% of them stated their role because, right, people are coming in and out all day. You don't know who is the phlebotomist and who's the physician. Only 9% of them actually sat down and looked the patient in the eye. So there's some very simple things to do, but they're not easy to do sometimes when physicians or medical students or residents are stressed, rushed, have a cognitive burden, right? So many things on their minds. So what we're hoping to do is actually create habits so that even when we're stressed, you know, we still all know to put the key in the engine, right, to start our car. It's a habit. And similarly with physicians and physicians in training, we're hoping to instill habits that are effective and that can flatten the hierarchy. The E is for education in the heart mnemonic. And there are educational disparities that are very thorny and persistent for minorities in this country. And unfortunately, we're still seeing a great deal of segregation in education, lack of qualified teachers. And what the patients taught me is that sometimes they felt that they didn't have enough knowledge to even ask questions about their conditions or treatment. And Judson, in the Journal of American Medical Association, coined the term white coat silence. And it would look something like, so what questions do you have about the prostate cancer treatment? And the patient might say, nothing. So a remedy, I'm interested in remedies, a remedy can be giving a menu of questions that we know are common. So I might say to that same patient, you know, people are often worried about, will there be pain with the treatment? Do I have to take this medication forever? How much does it cost? How much will it affect my sex life? I've never had a patient who didn't say, actually, that was on my mind. I'd like to talk about it. So a remedy for educational disparities and white coat silence. A is for acknowledge. And the reality is, as Michelle Obama said during her speech this week, that enslaved African Americans provided a great deal of labor to build the White House and other government buildings. Racism, oppression is a reality. I wish it weren't. And in my teaching physicians, I have to say this is one of the most difficult things for them to conceive of saying, to actually acknowledge the presence of disparities and of racism. And sometimes we've actually had to, like, feed the line to the physician in training to say, I wish I didn't have to ask this, but do you ever feel you've been treated differently? So a story from my own experience, I saw a patient for the first time, and she described seeing 5 specialists. And she said none of them provided her the care that was high quality. And she seemed extremely angry about it. And she told me in many, many different ways how disappointed and frustrated she was. So I said exactly that phrase, I wish I didn't have to ask, but do you feel you've been treated differently? And she said, yes, absolutely. I'm black, and I'm not getting the chemotherapy that I need to save my life. That opening the door and talking about the elephant in the room led us to have a much better relationship. She said she looked forward to coming to see me. I felt good about myself, right? That's the kind of relationship I want to have. So acknowledging reality in a way that's patient-centered. R is for respect. And the simple way I teach this remedy is actually using the term respect. I have a great deal of respect for you that you take 2 buses to get to the VA and you're on time every visit. I'm wowed by you and your dedication. Simple thing to do, builds a relationship, builds trust. And T is for trust in the heart mnemonic. And another case study one of the trainees, a young, idealistic, and very skilled young woman, saw a new patient and came to me and said, he's been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and he really feels he did not get the right treatment at another institution. So she had been practicing these phrases about trust. And when she said to the patient, trust grows over time. I want to earn your trust. At the end of that visit, she told me, he said, I want you to be my doctor forever. Isn't that what we all want as healthcare providers? Isn't that what we want as patients? And so there's an art and a science to this high-quality communication that can bridge racial and ethnic gaps. And it can be learned with time, effort, coaching, feedback. I want to give you just one other piece of interesting evidence about communication and race. This is a story of a study done in 14 different primary care sites on the East Coast. Most of the patients were African American or Black, and they had the radical notion of coaching doctors how to communicate better. Even more radical was they coached patients how to communicate more effectively with their doctors. And what they found is that with minimal intervention, there was a non-significant decrease in blood pressure. But with coaching physicians and patients, there was a 16-millimeter decrease in the blood pressure. That's better than most medications we use. And again, when we think about the disparity of cardiovascular disease, heart failure, kidney failure, all related to high blood pressure, we're really on to something here. Why aren't we spending more time, money, energy on communication? If we looked at a graph of the articles that I looked for and searched for in Google Scholar about the number of articles related to communication and high blood pressure control, it looked like a thin little sliver on the bar graph. The number of articles about pharmaceuticals and high blood pressure control, what do you guess? Yes, enormous. There are reasons. In the short run, I think it's easier to write a prescription than to spend 15 minutes educating someone. In the short run, I don't think so in the long term. So we've got some areas of hope, areas for research and discovery. Here's the graph. Communication and high blood pressure control, pharmaceuticals. And to my colleagues who say, I don't have time for empathy. This is a study of empathy and efficiency in doctor-patient encounters. And when physicians said empathetic statements, their visits were shorter and more efficient. And we think it's because the patient doesn't have to keep hammering what they're trying to get across over the doctor's head. They feel heard, and they can move on. So, caring, compassionate, building a relationship, reducing disparities, improving trust, satisfaction, and even being more efficient. So I want to talk about hope for the future. These are medical students at UCSF. Looks like the 70s, doesn't it? We're sitting cross-legged on the ground here. This was an innovation at UCSF. This is a two-day intensive on talking about race and relationships last year. As I said, UCSF When the students got our attention, we decided we needed to do something. And we had a program called Diversity, Inclusion, Bias, and Inequity. And it was for the very first week of medical school for first-year students. We spent a full 2 days training in basic communication and advanced communication around diversity. And though we were biting our nails about the evaluations, right? Would they like it? It was wildly successful in the students' view. They were hungry for these conversations. And on a scale of 1 to 5, they said their rating was 4.5 in terms of this allowed me to get to know my peers and faculty better. And in terms of acquiring skills to talk about diversity, they, again, it was about 4.3 on a scale of 1 to 5. Very, very successful. So this year, we're making it a 3-day intensive. And that's going to happen next week. Very excited about it. Very hopeful for me, being called by the students and responding to their needs. I'm going to skip this slide about the evaluations. The one thing that we weren't as successful with was increasing knowledge about bias. Part of it may be a lot of the students came in already from their undergraduate experiences knowing something about bias. Not sure. So in terms of some of the out-of-the-box remedies that we're looking at, cure for bias, slow thinking. We're finding that with mindfulness meditation, people's responses are less biased. Maybe we should have every medical student, every doctor trained in mindfulness. May it be so. I hope this is the future of medicine. Other things that we're looking at include loving kindness meditation, which has been shown to increase empathy. Something less ethereal, patient navigators, where someone is a guide or a coach and helps someone move from diagnosis to treatment. And there was a study on the East Coast with African-American patients, and I think it was with cancer, much more likely to get the screening. And remember, actually, I may not have told you, African-American women die of breast cancer 40% more than their white counterparts. African-American women are less likely to be screened and more likely to be diagnosed at a late stage. So getting a navigator helps women move through the system. Greater efficiency and trust. Power of personal narrative, that means our own stories. And Dr. Diana Burgess, who's a psychologist at University of Minnesota, has found that the process of getting to know someone as an individual instead of broad brushing them with bias has been shown to result in fewer biased behaviors. She calls it individuation. So actually at our intensive next week for the students, we have people come and give their personal stories. And we ask students and faculty from a variety of racial, ethnic, socioeconomic backgrounds in 10 minutes to tell something about their life stories. Very moving. I had to have Kleenex last year. I probably will this year too. Here's a radical notion that we begin to evaluate doctors in how unbiased they are. How facilitative they are in terms of diversity. How inclusive are they? How well have they mastered the language of empathy? Radical notion, but we may be moving in that direction. At UCSF, we're talking about it. And I'm going to end with what my professor taught me. When in doubt, ask the patient. I think we should really be conducting a lot more research with patients in terms of not only what satisfies them, but what increases trust, what do they feel is skillful language around diversity, and what keeps them coming back to get the health care that they need. So thank you for listening. and I think it's time for questions.
Any questions? Yes.
Okay, thank you for a very illuminating talk. I realized toward the end that it seemed like everything you were talking about was from the perspective of the range of the practice of medicine in the United States. So I guess my question is, have you done a comparison of these topics as in, say, Europe versus the United States?
Great question. There is a lot of diversity in the UK, and there are papers from the UK about how to incorporate diversity training in medical school and nursing curriculum. But you're bumping up against one of my limitations. I'm really focused on medical education and healthcare in the United States. But great question. Yeah.
Yes. Do you need a microphone?
No.
Oh, yes, we need it for the recording, sir, actually. Thank you.
Gary, Malaysian. Actually, what you're dealing with is not only deals with medicine, it deals across the culture, especially the American culture, because our communication skills are severely lacking. We never get into the meat of the subject. And fundamentally, this is sales training. That's really what you're doing. and what you're trying to teach the doctors to do is to sell themselves to the patient so that they get the most out of the patient. This is actually a good sales training tool. I used to teach salesmanship, and I used to teach things like this.
I did not plant you in the audience, but thank you.
This isn't really a question, but by chance today I filled out a survey for Sutter Pacific Health Center about a visit with my physician. And they asked all these questions. Did you feel listened to? Did your doctor feel interested? Did you feel the person was rushed? What is your ethnicity? And so I'm so impressed to see that some people are in the real world really acting on some of your excellent work.
Good news. Thank you.
Mine, too, is a comment. I'm not accustomed to taking medicine. I don't like taking medicine, but I like my doctor, and I'm pretty convinced I'm taking my prescriptions only because I like her. She took the time to talk to me. On my own, if I were faced with the kind of doctor that I grew up with, you know, the in terms of the rare occasions when I actually saw a doctor, as a youngster, there was just one black MD in town, and he was the only one who made house calls, and we only called him if someone broke a bone or if the fever went above 102. Otherwise, our grandmother's remedies could take care of it. But if I were dealing with the kind of doctor that most women saw decades ago, the white male who was very distant, very hierarchical, I'm sure I wouldn't take the medication that I take today. My doctor listens. My doctor is a female. My doctor respects who I am. And so I know that this makes a difference from my own personal experience.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really interesting. I was wondering about, you talked about the study where the it was found that there was more trust and empathy when the race of the patient and the doctor were the same, and you gave examples of an African-American doctor and African-American patient. Is that true across other racial categories, or was that not the focus of the study? I'm just wondering, I don't know if you want to use Asian or even specific, maybe even nationality. Language, I assume, makes a difference.
Yes, great question. African-Americans had been the largest minority in the United States. That's not true anymore. So a lot of the medical literature in terms of cross-cultural communication is about the black-white difference. that's going to change now over time as the percentage of Asian and Latino people in the country increase. But I think a lot of the medical literature, some of the seminal studies, it just hasn't caught up. But you're right about language concordance. There are quite a few studies about that. It's a duh kind of thing, isn't it? That you want someone to speak your mother tongue. But I also find it really interesting that Hispanic patients really are looking for empathy also, as it's really an important, no matter what the language. And I was teaching a group of colon rectal surgeons in Minneapolis, a sensitive area, and we workshopped together for a whole weekend about communication. They have a lot of Somali patients, and none of the physicians speak that language. And we came up with the phrase through the interpreter, "I wish I spoke your language." So humble, so personable. And I've tried it. It has never failed to generate a broad smile in the patient. And again, so simple. But we have to bring our attention to it in order to solve the problem.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Davis. It was absolutely a pleasure. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see
you. Hi, I am a physician, and I have a youthful appearance, and I find that is an obstacle in a lot of my patient interactions. And you've kind of given some of these statements that are kind of disarming and lend themselves to like open-ended communication. I was wondering if perhaps in your earlier time, if you had any statements that might engender some sort of trust in somebody who thinks you look like you shouldn't be driving a car.
Stereotype. There you go. In working with transference, because that's really what you're talking about, what patients project onto you, there are a variety of ways that some of the trainees have learned to cope with it. And I'll tell you about how I've learned to cope with it, because I'm at the VA and I see primarily male patients. Once a comment like that comes up, I'll say, here I am, a middle-aged African-American woman, talking to you about male issues. It might seem that I really couldn't possibly understand or know what's going on with you, and yet I'm your doctor, and I'm devoted to you. I'd like to hear whatever you have to share with me today. So actually naming the elephant in the room, which may be the transference, how people see us. And I've had men say, yeah, it is kind of weird that I'm meeting with you. But since you're my doctor, I'll tell you anyway. So thank you for the question. Yes, I look forward to talking with you afterward.
Okay. I think we're out of time now, Dr. Davis. It was really a wonderful presentation, and thank you so much.